Let's talk money, specifically the $9.2 billion question buried in a Harvard Business School working paper that HN picked up today. The paper's argument is that credit card rewards programs represent a systematic wealth transfer from low-income to high-income consumers, and the mechanism is more direct than most people realize.
The core finding is that when retailers accept credit cards and charge uniform prices regardless of payment method, which is how most retail works, they're implicitly including the interchange fee that card networks charge in their prices. Everyone pays that embedded fee, including cash and debit card users, but only rewards card holders get the cash back, miles, and points funded by those interchange fees. The net result is a transfer of roughly $9.2 billion annually, with the flow running from lower-income consumers who disproportionately use cash and basic cards toward higher-income consumers who disproportionately hold premium rewards cards.
This is a well-documented phenomenon in academic economics. There's a body of research going back to work by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston on payment system distributional effects. What's notable about this particular paper is the quantification. $9.2 billion is a concrete number that makes the abstract argument tangible. The HN thread went in several directions, including whether merchants should be allowed to charge different prices for different payment methods, which is actually legal in most US states now but rarely practiced.
This brings up a useful moment for what I'd call a structural primer on market competition law, because the credit card case brushes up against it. The reason Visa and MasterCard's network rules, which historically prohibited merchants from surcharging, faced antitrust scrutiny, is rooted in the Sherman Act, passed in 1890. The act has two main sections. Section 1 prohibits agreements that restrain trade, and Section 2 prohibits monopolization or attempts to monopolize. What's crucial is that having a large market share alone doesn't make you a monopolist under U.S. law. The legal standard requires using that market power to harm competition through exclusionary conduct, predatory pricing, or anti-competitive agreements.
In the credit card context, the no surcharge rules were challenged as Section 1 violations, agreements among network members that restrained the pricing freedom of merchants. The Supreme Court's 2018 Ohio v. American Express decision actually sided with Amex, finding that because card networks operate as two-sided markets, serving both merchants and cardholders, you have to look at the competitive effects on both sides together. It's a case that antitrust scholars are still debating, because it effectively said that a two-sided platform can justify restrictions on one side if they produce benefits on the other. The analogy is something like a newspaper. You can't just look at whether the subscription price is predatory without also considering the advertising side of the business.
The practical implication for consumers is that the credit card reward system is functioning largely as intended by the card networks. Profitable for premium cardholders, cross-subsidized by everyone else, and legally protected by a Supreme Court ruling that defines competition in ways that favor the incumbent platforms. Whether that's good policy is a separate question from whether it's legal.
From financial infrastructure to physical infrastructure, the data center story is one that deserves more attention than it got on HN today. The EPA is proposing to change air pollution permitting rules in ways that would allow data center construction without the public comment periods that currently apply to industrial facilities. The framing from the administration is about removing regulatory barriers to AI infrastructure build-out.
The environmental concern is real and specific. Data centers in the current AI build cycle are enormous consumers of electricity and water, and they typically rely on diesel backup generators that are significant local pollution sources. The public comment requirement exists precisely to give local communities a voice when a large industrial facility is proposed near them. Removing that requirement doesn't make the pollution disappear. It makes the process of opposing it much harder.
There's a genuine tension here between two legitimate interests. The U.S. government has decided that AI infrastructure is strategically important and wants to accelerate its construction. Public comment processes do add time and cost. But suppress pushback is the phrasing in the original Tom Hardware headline, and the HN community flagged that framing as pointed but not inaccurate, The mechanism being changed genuinely reduces the public's ability to object.
The Indonesia bomb phishing story is harder to summarize without getting angry, honestly. The Yale Environment 360 piece documents the ongoing destruction of coral reef ecosystems by illegal blast fishing, where fishermen use homemade explosives to stun or kill fish. The practice is devastatingly efficient at collecting fish and devastatingly efficient at destroying the reef structures that sustain fish populations over time.
The economic logic is tragic in the classic commons tragedy sense. Individual fishermen facing immediate economic pressure choose the high-yield short-term option even though it destroys the long-term resource they depend on. Indonesia has laws against blast fishing, but enforcement across a 17,000-island archipelago with limited Coast Guard resources is essentially impossible in many areas.
The HN comments were genuinely thoughtful on this one, less tech-centric than usual, which happens when a story touches something viscerally real. Several people noted that coral reef systems support roughly a quarter of all marine species and provide coastal protection to hundreds of millions of people, and that the reef destruction timeline is measured in years, while the recovery timeline, if recovery is even possible, is measured in decades.
Now, before we leave this segment, and I think this is the right place for it, I want to spend a few minutes on a question that the OpenAI Jalapeno story raised that we didn't fully interrogate earlier. What if the custom silicon beats NVIDIA narrative is wrong?
Say more. What's the strongest version of the counterargument?
The claim is that Jalapeno outperforms Blackwell on OpenAI's specific workloads. The assumption baked into the excitement around this is that outperforms on specific workloads will generalize into outperforms broadly and eventually NVIDIA's dominance ends. But there's a strong reason to doubt that inference. Every company that has built custom AI silicon has faced the same challenge. The hardware is optimized for the workload profile at build time, and AI workloads are not static.
That's a real concern. Google's TPUs have been around since 2016, and they haven't displaced NVIDIA. Google still buys enormous quantities of NVIDIA GPUs. The reason is that TPUs are excellent for the specific transformer architectures Google optimized them for. But when a new architecture emerges, mixture of experts, state space models, whatever comes next, the custom silicon requires a new design cycle, while NVIDIA can push a software update to CUDA and the existing hardware adapts.
Exactly. NVIDIA's real moat isn't just the hardware, it's CUDA, which is a 20-year software ecosystem. Researchers write in CUDA. Frameworks are optimized for CUDA. The entire training and inference stack assumes CUDA availability. Even if Jalapeno is faster for transformer inference today, OpenAI has to maintain a shadow software ecosystem for their custom hardware that doesn't benefit from 20 years of community development.
The scenario where we're wrong about NVIDIA's durability is AI workloads converge on stable enough architectures that custom silicon optimization doesn't get disrupted by the next architectural shift. If transformers with attention mechanisms remain the dominant paradigm for the next decade, which is at least plausible given how deep the infrastructure investment in them is, then custom silicon optimized for attention computation could hold its advantage longer than historical precedent suggests.
What to watch for? Whether OpenAI publishes benchmark methodology that shows Jalapeno maintaining its advantage across different model sizes and sequence lengths, not just the specific configuration where it happens to win. If the advantage is robust across a range of workloads, the counterargument weakens. If it's narrow and brittle, that's the signal that custom silicon is a cost optimization rather than a platform shift.